Good day. Today is Sunday, 28th September 2025, and today we are in the middle of a parliamentary election in Moldova, the former Soviet Republic of Moldova. A very small place, certainly a small place in population terms, on the fringes of the European Union, place bordering Romania. Most of the population speaks Romanian, but a country that has had very long historic ties and associations with Russia, which was formerly a part of the Russian Empire, and then after the Second World War became a part of the Soviet Union. Anyway, this small place, poor, its people, apparently amongst the poorest in Europe, is now a strategic geopolitical battlefield through no choice of their own, with the current president, Maria Sandu, framing the entire parliamentary election as basically an election between herself and her party and what she likes to call the pro-European and pro-Western course, and supposedly Russia. Russia is the other party in the election. A fact that there are no Russian candidates standing in the election. The fact that all of the claims that have been made that Maria Sandu's opponents, which basically consists of all of the other parties so far as I can see in the Moldovan parliament, are Moldovan parties. Some of them do seem to want better relations with Russia, but anyway, despite the fact that her own economic achievements, or legacy if you prefer, is, to put it mildly, mixed. Well, we're not supposed to talk about any of that. We are supposed to focus instead on Russia and Russia's role or alleged role in this election. Now, I have real problems here because though I have read acres, piles of articles and printed words, and I've heard endless comments and statements about the Russian role in the election, the vast amount of Russian money that is supposedly entering the election, and all of this, actual evidence that this is the case, I have frankly never seen. I can't find any of it. Maybe somewhere squirreled away in some place there are suspicious transfers of money or something of that kind. I doubt that they can be on anything like the kind of scale that people are saying. And yet, the entire European media, the entire Western media is going along with this extraordinary claim that this is an election between Maria Sandu and her party on the one hand and Russia on the other. And the entire election is being framed in that way, not on the government's record, not on Maria Sandu's own record, not on the needs or concerns or worries or fears of the people of Moldova, but it is entirely explained and represented in these geopolitical terms. And beyond that, of course, even though, as I've said, I have found little to no evidence, I mean, I personally have found little to no evidence of Russian interference in the election. I'm not saying that there has been none. I'm only saying that I have not been able to see it. But even though I have found no evidence of this Russian interference in the election, evidence of interference by the Western powers, by the European Union, is there and it is everywhere. European officials make no secret of their desire that Maria Sandu wins. They support actions taken by the Moldovan authorities to ban two political parties which are said to be pro-Russian, literally on the eve of the elections. Exactly upon what basis these parties are banned, We're told that it's because these parties are anti-NATO. So apparently banning a party in Moldova because it has doubts about Moldova's prospects of one day joining the NATO alliance or joining the EU, that is supposedly a grounds now for banning a political party in Moldova. I find that, by the way, extraordinary. And those who support free elections, plurality of views, diversity of views, democratic processes, well, apparently in the West, they have absolutely nothing to say about any of that. We also have issues about whether people who are Moldovan citizens, happen to live in Russia, as many millions apparently do, are able to vote. Maybe not millions, but certainly hundreds of thousands apparently do. They're not able to vote in the elections because they cannot get access to polling stations. Moldovans in the European Union who can get access to polling stations, of course, they're being encouraged and supported in their votes. Anyway, everything is being done, basically, as far as I can see, to frame this election as a geopolitical conflict and to assist in every conceivable way the incumbent European officials who complain about Russian interference but provide no real evidence of it, show no hesitation in interfering in the election themselves. Now, all of this for a small country, 2.5 million people, I believe, is the size of the entire population. A country that perhaps its people, left to themselves, would not want to be a geopolitical battleground in that way. And what difference ultimately is this going to make in the great scheme of things? I ought to add that on top of everything else, there are now all kinds of lurid claims or warnings of Ukrainian military intervention in Moldova if the vote goes wrong. There's even some claims, which I don't know how valid they are, that the election might be cancelled entirely in the way that the Romanian election, presidential election that took place last year, was, if the vote goes the wrong way. Well, all of this to achieve what in the end? To dragoon another small country, which might not be keen on this, into joining the Western family of nations? Is this what this is all about? Is this even going to work? Or is it perhaps more because the West can't let things go, can't let events take their course, because they are familiar, they know that the situation in Europe is becoming increasingly difficult and increasingly complicated, that populations across Europe are becoming increasingly angry and unnerved by the direction of events? They sense that economic and social conditions are getting worse, and for that reason, the European elites have to tighten their grip even on small countries like Moldova because they cannot risk letting them go. The same, by the way, appears to be true of the Czech Republic, where there are similar threats and noises about Russian interference in the elections that are shortly due there as well, and already attempts being made to prevent the former Prime Minister, Mr. Babiš, and his party from winning the elections. Though whether Mr. Babiš is even pro-Russian, I have absolutely no idea. I saw little sign of it when he was Prime Minister, little meaningful sign of it when he was Prime Minister before. But anyway, all of this is going on in Moldova. And well, to myself, who perhaps spends too much time thinking about historical matters, I can't pretend that he doesn't remind me of a certain event that took place in Central and Eastern Europe in October 1944. It was a small country then, in that case it was Hungary, which also was perhaps anxious to try to come to some kind of understanding with the Russians. This in the context of another great geopolitical conflict and indeed world war, which the Russians were winning. And of course, the German government of that time wasn't willing to let that happen. And the result was a regime change operation carried out by Germany in October 1944 in Budapest, which ensured that Hungary did indeed remain an ally of Germany right up until the bitter end of that war, which of course lasted no more than a further 6 months. I say this because of course we are also involved in a war today, nowhere near as massive or as grave or as consequential as the one that was fought in Europe in the 1940s. But there is a war going on. It is going on in Ukraine. And of course, the West is losing that war, or at least the European elite sense that they are losing that war. And they're becoming increasingly alarmed that their American ally seems to be disassociating itself from that war, which is being lost. And I cannot help myself, despite the fact that I accept that there are many, many differences between the parallels, I can't help myself but think that just as was the case in October 1944, so today, Moldova cannot be allowed to follow its own course, because doing so is going to somehow undermine the policies of people in Berlin, though also, of course, in Brussels and elsewhere in Europe too. Anyway, that's my thoughts about this election. I'll be interested to see the outcome. If the outcome goes the wrong way, I'll be interested to see what the reaction in Europe is. I doubt that it will be pretty, but anyway, we will see how it turns out. I am going to say nothing more about this election until I know the outcome, which will presumably be late this evening or perhaps tomorrow. Anyway, let's move on and discuss the real war, the one that is playing out just, well, a couple of hundred miles to the east of unhappy Moldova, the war that is being fought in Ukraine. And let's begin, first of all, with what the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, said in the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Lavrov there categorically denied all claims, all suggestions that Russia has any plan to conquer Europe. I mean, the fact that Lavrov has to deny this is in itself extraordinary, because the entire premise, the whole theory that Russia is looking to conquer Europe or attack other European countries is on its face, frankly, ridiculous. That the Russians should actually want to march on Berlin, Paris, London. Nobody ever explains why they would want to do any of these things. There is a great deal of concern about the Baltic states and about the situation of the Baltic states. There is a novel, it is a novel, a futuristic novel that's been published recently, which talks about a possible Russian attempt to march into Estonia, manufacturing after having manufactured, the Russians having manufactured some kind of crisis in the Estonian town of Narva, a town which, by the way, from what I have heard, has a predominantly Russian population. Well, I don't believe that anything like that is being planned in Moscow. Why would it be? And if there are problems in the Baltic states, surely the right way to deal with those problems is not to heighten tensions in the Baltic, but to address any actual problems that might exist in Narva, something that nobody in the West ever wants to talk about, but which I believe to be very real. But anyway, despite the fact that, as I said, I think the suggestion that the Russians have some kind of plan to conquer Europe or significant parts of Europe is inherently absurd. Nonetheless, Lavrov responded to that, and in the atmosphere of paranoia and hysteria that is sweeping Europe today, where a Russian spy ship, it's not as if we don't have any spy ships in the West. Anyway, a Russian spy ship moving around the European seas, and bear in mind, Russia itself, as a European country, is itself on the boundaries of those seas. Anyway, this itself is apparently now classified as a massive and terrifying threat. Anyway, Lavrov had to deny that claim because, given the level of paranoia, he had no choice. But he did, in other respects, give a whole series of very strong warnings. He said that if there are attacks on the Russians, if their aircraft are indeed shot down, as some people in Europe are now suggesting, then there will be an immediate response. And I think this is a warning that needs to be taken very seriously, because shooting down aircraft is an act of war, especially if there are questions as to where those aircraft are located, as there are almost certainly going to be. Certainly, shooting down aircraft without giving prior warnings would be an incredibly aggressive step. Anyway, Lavrov gave that warning, and he gave the warning that though the Russians have no offensive intentions with respect to Europe, if they feel themselves under attack, then they will take action as they see it to defend themselves. And again, I don't think these warnings should be disregarded. In all other respects, Lavrov's comments, incidentally, at the UN General Assembly were very much in line with what we've been hearing from Moscow, well, over the last 9 months. Despite the recent offensive language that President Trump has used about the Russians, Lavrov said that the Russians still believe or still assume that the President of the United States and his officials are embarking on a much more realistic trajectory. They seem to be taking serious and sincere steps to stabilize the international situation, at least as between Russia and the United States, and to path a more constructive way forward. But Lavrov said that the Europeans are not like that at all. They continue to seek constant confrontation. And, well, one might have questions about whether the Russians are right about the Americans. I know many people think otherwise, but about the Europeans, there can be no doubt at all. Every day, we see more and more proof and more evidence that the Europeans indeed are locked inside a narrative of seeking constant confrontation. So anyway, that was Lavrov. That was Lavrov at the General Assembly. He's had many meetings there with all sorts of officials. He's spoken, obviously, with Marco Rubio, the US Secretary of State. Meeting lasted around 50 minutes, which is about average, by the way, for meetings of this kind. Lavrov has also met leaders, or rather foreign representatives of many governments. But again, I noticed that no European government or official met with him. He had no contacts with any of the leading European governments, the British, the French, the Germans, the Spanish, the Italians. None of them were prepared to speak with him. I continue to think that this is a grave, even catastrophic mistake. But this policy of not talking to the Russians, even as the situation in Europe deteriorates, well, that continues to hold. In the meantime, the war itself goes on. And last night, over a period of apparently 12 hours, the Russians conducted what some are saying was the biggest combined missile and drone strike against Ukraine since the very start of the special military operation in February 2022. Now, interestingly, the Ukrainians have provided no information about the success or otherwise of their air defense system. They've not said how many drones were launched, at least not as at the time of this program, or how many missiles the Russians launched. The Ukrainians have made some really astonishing claims that Hungarian drones, which they claim infringed their territory, were providing guidance to Russian drones and missiles. This is not, it must be said, in connection with his very latest strike, but other strikes. That is an absurd claim. The idea that the Russians, who have satellite surveillance and electronic surveillance and large numbers of spies now all over Ukraine, who are able to hack into Ukrainian communications and who have multiple means of surveillance of Ukrainian territories, cannot establish the physical presence of targets for their drones and missiles. I believe the Ukrainian claims were specifically related to the American-owned electronics factory that was attacked in western Ukraine back in August, as if the Russians wouldn't know its whereabouts and would have to rely on Hungarian drones to guide them. Anyway, this is absurd. But anyway, regardless of claims like that, the Ukrainians, in relation to this last attack, so far, as of the time of making of this program, have not provided us with a breakdown of the number of Russian drones, the number of Russian missiles, the mix of Russian missiles that were used over the course of this 12-hour attack. It has been suggested that this was the biggest. It's been suggested that at least 500 drones were used and that roughly 60 missiles, which would be a large quantity of missiles. And it's been said that this was a complex mix of missiles, that hypersonic missiles were used, that ballistic missiles, Iskander missiles were used, that cruise missiles, KH-101s and sea-launched Calibre missiles were all used, and that they all participated in one form or another over the course of this massive attack. Now, the Russians are saying that this attack targeted Ukrainian military industrial facilities, factories, and other workshops that produce industrial and military equipment. And they also say that the attack also targeted airfields. And one airfield that the Russians do seem to have targeted is the giant airbase at Starokonstantinov in central western Ukraine, built by the Soviet Union. It was where the Soviet Union used to base its Sukhoi 24 bomber fleets during the Cold War. It was now used by the Ukrainians for their F-16s and other Western-supplied aircraft, and whatever Sukhoi 24s they still have left. But mostly, the attack seems to have been focused again on Kiev and on the areas around. And there is no doubt that some damage was done to residential buildings, to apartment buildings. Again, I don't believe that the Russians intentionally targeted those buildings. I can't see any logic in the Russians conducting a massive missile and drone strike and then targeting one of their missiles in the context of such a vast strike against a single residential building in a city like Kiev. Either the missile malfunctioned or drone malfunctioned, or Ukrainian air defense caused it to go off course, or the attack was the result of debris falling from a falling drone or missile, or perhaps it was a Ukrainian air defense missile falling to earth. I am not going to speculate because I don't know. Again, we would need a proper investigation to find out the truth, and that kind of investigation is never going to happen. But that this was a devastating and huge attack, of that there is no doubt. And President Zelensky responded, and he said that if attacks like these continue, if the Russians continue and carry out attacks leading to a power blackout across Ukraine, then the Ukrainians will retaliate, and presumably using American supplied weapons, because I can't see how else it can be done, the Ukrainians will carry out attacks leading to an energy blackout in Moscow. Now, I'm not going to say that this is a completely empty threat by Zelensky. He probably, the Ukrainians probably, certainly if they get the missiles from the West, they would be able to do damage to the colossal power generating system in Moscow. Though I doubt that the damage would be that extensive, and it would certainly be capable of rapid repair. The Russians would be able to repair it very quickly. So I am not saying that this is a completely empty threat, but to repeat a point I have made many times, the Russians are able to sustain these kind of aerial offensives, drone and missile offensives, night after night, week after week, month after month. They've been doing it for many months and weeks now. They started their offensive, their aerial offensive in the sky against the Ukrainians in October 2022. There have been periods of relative remission, and there have been other periods when the attacks have become more intense. Steadily, they have become more intense as the war has dragged on. And as we see, they have now reached a new peak of intensity. Ukraine, even with Western backing, cannot match this. The Ukrainians can launch some missiles, against the Russians, but if we're talking about Taurus missiles, for example, apparently the most that the Germans can supply is 150, and 150 Taurus missiles, we'll compare that to the 60 missiles that the Russians are supposed to have launched against Ukraine just last night. If the Western powers start giving cruise missiles to the Ukrainians to conduct an aerial offensive against the Russians, the Western powers will face the same problem very quickly that they have already encountered with air defense missiles. They will run through their missiles very fast, and given that they would be coming up against the Russian air defense system, which is vastly more sophisticated and advanced than the Ukrainian, or indeed than the air defense systems which exist in the West, they would only be able to do limited damage. And given that we are talking about an air offensive against the world's biggest country, by far the world's biggest country in terms of area, a country with an enormous and widely dispersed energy system and industrial base, we can very quickly see how, even if the Russians took no offensive action in response, all that kind of offensive would do is create more problems further down the line, not just for the Ukrainians, but for the Western powers as well. They would very quickly run out of aerial missiles, and by the time that they were running short, they would find that, of course, the build-up of missiles, both by the Russians and by the Russians' allies, by the Chinese and others, would put the West in a position of massive disadvantage. Now, I say that just to repeat again, if we were to see a missile offensive against Moscow, against other Russian cities, against the Russian energy system using Western missiles, that would be a massive escalation. And I think it is inconceivable that the Russians would not respond much more aggressively than they have done up to now. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, they now also have missiles like the Oreshnik, far more powerful than any missile in the West's arsenal. And Lavrov yesterday gave warnings that the Russians would not sit on their hands, and that they have the means to take counteraction. So anyway, there we go. A massive strike by the Russians and a furious response from Zelensky. And to come back to my point, whilst I don't think that Zelensky's words were entirely bluff, I think that they are mostly bluff. I think that they are ultimately a product of anger drawn from frustration because Ukraine cannot really respond to these Russian strikes. It cannot defend itself against them. And Zelensky deep down knows that it is not in a position to provide a counter, not even if the West were to provide the support that Ukraine seeks. So anyway, a massive Russian strike. And of course, all of this is happening even as the situation on the battlefronts, the actual battlefronts, where the fighting is taking place, continues to go further and further against Ukraine. Now, let's begin by the situation in Zaporozhye region. The Russians continue their advance towards the city of Zaporozhye, both from the south, where they're fighting now to capture the town of Stepnogorsk. The latest reports put the Russians in the center of this supposedly well-fortified town. It looks as if Stepnogorsk eventually is going to be captured by the Russians, probably not very long. But as I have discussed already, north of Stepnogorsk is some kind of large water body, a reservoir or a tributary of the Dnieper, or perhaps a lake, which to me looks like it provides a barrier against further northward advance. I doubt that the Russians intend to advance on Zaporozhye City from the south. They have been bombing Zaporozhye City intensively recently. The Ukrainians claim that they shot down a Russian Sukhoi 34 jet that was involved in bombing Zaporozhye City. That might be true, I don't know. But the Russians, for their part, have provided video footage of the Russians conducting missile strikes that have destroyed a Patriot missile system that was seeking to defend Zaporozhye City from these Russian bombing raids. But the main threat to the city of Zaporozhye comes from the east. The Russians still have a long way to go until they reach the city of Zaporozhye. But their eastward advance, or rather their westward advance from Donbass deeper into Zaporozhye region continues remorselessly. They are now apparently taking their first steps to storm Uspenivka and Poltavka. Video footage has appeared of Russian drones operating over these two villages, these two big villages. It looks as if a Russian assault on these villages might be just days away. And it's been suggested that if the Russians capture these two villages, the village immediately to the north of Veliko Mikhailovka will probably also be attacked and captured fairly quickly, at which point the Russians have no further obstacles for further advance until they reach a supply road, a major supply road, leading from the north to the important town of Guliapolye. If they cut that supply road, then Guliapolye itself is essentially encircled. The Ukrainians probably would not be able to defend themselves in Guliapolye for very long if the Ukrainians have to abandon Guliapolye or are defeated there. Then the Russians can advance further towards the next important town, which is Orekhov, which would at that point become undefendable. And then there is nothing left once Orekhov is captured between the Russians and Zaporozhye City itself and the Dnieper. Just saying. There continue to be lots of reports that the Russians at some point are preparing some kind of operation across the Dnieper towards Kherson City and towards Odessa. And prior to this latest big Russian combined drone and missile strike, the one that took place last night, the Russians also have been conducting intense strikes in the area around the city of Odessa. And it's been suggested that this is intended to prepare the ground for an eventual cross-river operation, or perhaps even amphibious operation, to storm Odessa itself, or perhaps to recapture the town of Kherson first, which lies on the western bank of the Dnieper. I have already expressed my own belief that I don't think that this is going to happen. Now, I think we're too late in the year for this. I think that conducting operations of this kind in the autumn and the winter would be extremely difficult. I think it is more likely that the Russians are going to remain focused on the Donbass and on clearing Zaporozhye. But if Ukraine is still in fighting in the spring, then assuming that the Russians have reached the Dnieper by then, a cross Dnieper operation in 2026 is a real possibility. But the main battle, in my opinion, continues to be the one that is being fought out in Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka. And yesterday, a cascade of reports started to appear, which basically confirmed the earlier claims by Rodovka that the Russians not only control all of western Pokrovsk, but that they control large areas of central Pokrovsk, and that they have crossed the railway lines into northern Pokrovsk and are now attacking an industrial region to the north of Pokrovsk itself. And the Rodovka has also been making claims for some time that in the area of Mirnograd and Novoekonomichne, a Ukrainian brigade, the 79th Brigade, has been largely destroyed by the Russians, and that the Russians have been working towards a storming operation of Mirnograd as well. In other words, the Russian pincers have been closing on Ukrainian positions in Pokrovsk. And I think I mentioned yesterday that there are now comments by Ukrainian soldiers in southeastern Pokrovsk, where most of the Ukrainian army is located in Pokrovsk, the Ukrainian forces are located in Pokrovsk, that they are running out of supplies because the main roads are cut. So all of this now, the battle for Pokrovsk itself is well understood. It's a long, difficult battle because we're talking about a big town, but the Russians have made significant progress in it. But the Ukrainians still hold out in the areas to the south and east of Pokrovsk, the more built-up areas, the areas with the high-rise Soviet-era apartment buildings. And I'm guessing that Mirnograd is also rather like that too. So we're probably close to the point where resistance by the Ukrainians is going to break there. But saying that doesn't mean that it's going to happen tomorrow or next week. There's still a battle to fight there. The more complex battle, the very chaotic battle, as I noticed that some supposedly neutral, which is to say Western mapping projects, are now saying, is the battle that's taking place in northeast Pokrovsk, the Battle of Dobropilia, as the Russians call it. They refer to this as the Dobropilia direction. This is the area where the Russians made their breakthrough northeast of Pokrovsk back in August. The Ukrainians have been carrying out counterattacks in this area. As I discussed in my program yesterday, the Rodovka has provided its own account of these counterattacks. It's conceded that the Ukrainians have gained ground, but it has also claimed at various times that the Ukrainian forces that advanced into Russian positions in the southern part of this area of breakthrough are now themselves in effect surrounded, that Russian troops from the 51st and 8th armies who have been deployed to this area have been able to encircle the Ukrainian troops in places like Vladimirovka and other places which the Ukrainians have claimed to have captured. And over the last 24 hours, we've had the first information that that might actually be true, because in the area immediately to the east of the village of Belitska, which appears to be the major Ukrainian advance base in this area, the village in which the Ukrainians conduct their attacks, the Ukrainians pushed eastward and they advanced towards certain villages, Russian-controlled villages, east of Belitska. But over the last 24 hours, there have been Russian counterattacks, supposedly, and though the Ukrainians have reached some of these villages, it seems that the Russians have indeed now essentially surrounded them. This is a very complex battle, and there are reports that the Russians are sending more troops to this area and that they're now planning, and this has been discussed for some time, that once these Ukrainian counterattacks have been fully defeated and all of the positions that the Ukrainians currently occupy and which the Russians previously occupied have been recaptured, that the Russians, against weakened Ukrainian resistance, are going to go on the counterattack in this area as well, and not only recover lost ground, but go on the offensive beyond it and work towards, in effect, capturing Dobropilia itself and encircling the town of Konstantinovka, which lies some distance to the east. And by the way, there's lots of reports about fighting in the Konstantinovka area as well, which I'm not going to discuss in any detail. The Russians claim that they've now largely, mostly cleared the territory to the south of the Kliban Bik Reserve. They say that the Ukrainian soldiers who were there were some of the most committed of soldiers in the Ukrainian army, drawn from the 12th Azov Brigade, but they've been mostly killed or wounded or have fled. And anyway, there's more fighting going on there too. And elsewhere, with every day, more reports now from the Ukrainians that they're losing more ground in Kupiansk. It's been said that the major position that the Ukrainians still hold in Kupiansk is a micro-district in the south of Kupiansk called the Yubileyny micro-district, another one of these high-rise building places. And that once this particular micro-district is lost, and it's everybody accepts that it will be lost, then further defence in Kupiansk becomes impossible. Kupiansk completely falls under the control of the Russians, and any Ukrainian troops still on the eastern side of the Oskol River in the Kupiansk area are trapped beyond any possibility of escape. Now, yesterday, the Ukrainian authorities announced that all remaining civilians from Kupiansk must leave. They claim that it's around 800. The civilian population of Kupiansk numbers around 800. And they said that anybody who leaves cannot leave on foot. Sorry, cannot leave by motor vehicle. They must leave on foot. And that they can only do so under the guidance and in the company of the Ukrainian military. Now, I interpret this, I have to say, as signaling an attempt by the Ukrainians to remove their military forces from Kupiansk. I say that because I can't imagine that there are really that many civilians left in Kupiansk, and I can't imagine that any civilians who are still there are people who actually want to leave Kupiansk. They're probably the most determined to stay. And the fact that this announcement has been made in the way that it has, it seems to me that it's a way of dressing up a retreat from Kupiansk as a civilian evacuation. That's my guess. I might be wrong. As I always say, I am not there. But anyway, it's clear, and nobody, either on the Ukrainian or on the Russian side, who follows the war closely, is in any doubt any longer that this battle, the Battle of Kupiansk, is now ending. Elsewhere, Russians continue to advance in the areas around Siversk and close to Liman. The Russians continue their advances, in other words, all along the front lines. And we continue to see crumbling defenses, the Ukrainians short of men and short of supplies, and complaining that they lack drones in anything like the sufficient quantities to help them hold their positions. I read a rather bitter comment by a Ukrainian soldier commenting on General Zaluzhny's claims about how Ukraine, in order to successfully defend itself, must adopt new technologies. And it's now, I think, clear that he means drone technologies and robot technologies and all of that. Anyway, this soldier said, that's fine, that's all very well, but in order to succeed in that, you actually need to have the technological advantage. And Ukraine doesn't. The Russians do. It's the Russians who operate now the more sophisticated drones. It's they who operate the fiber optic drones. The Ukrainians never were able to develop or use them on anything like the kind of scale that the Russians do. The Russians have now unveiled their first hunter-killer drone based entirely on AI, which supposedly doesn't even require inputs, whether through radio signals or fiber optic cables. Whether it really will be used on any big scale remains to be seen. And of course, the Russians have far more drones now over the sky than the Ukrainians do. And my impression is that the balance is shifting further to the Russians, ever further towards the Russians, every single day. So Zelensky can talk about offensives, and he might, for all I know, as I've said in my program, come up with some kind of idea for an attack in some place. He might talk about blackout of Moscow. He can, as I discussed in my program yesterday, threaten directly Russian leaders and tell them to stay close to their bunkers. But the reality is that whatever he does and whatever he threatens, he cannot change the imbalance in the war, which continues to shift steadily and remorselessly against him and against Ukraine. And the Americans are unable to provide Ukraine with the air defense cover that it needed. As I discussed in my program yesterday and in other programs. We don't hear anything more now about security guarantees. We don't hear anything more about reassurance forces being sent to Ukraine to enforce ceasefires or anything like that. We don't hear about large weapons deliveries to Ukraine on the scale that we used to hear about in 2023, for example, or to some extent in 2024. And I think that Zelensky perhaps has now come to understand that Donald Trump's comments about Ukraine winning the war, Ukraine being able to recover all of its territories, in effect, was a way of throwing Ukraine under the bus. Because what Ukraine really needs is not a continuation of the war, but an ending of it, even if you still harbor expectations or desire that Ukraine recover its lost territories. Ukraine has to stop fighting in order to rebuild and reorganize and rearm and reequip. The previous American policy of wanting a ceasefire made more sense from Ukraine's point of view than the latest policy that President Trump has announced of cheering Ukraine on until it achieves its entirely fictitious imaginary victory. So this is what all of the European leaders know. Deep down, I've no doubt that they know it, and it is what the Ukrainians themselves also know, that the war in Ukraine is being lost, that the Americans are indeed walking away, that they are revisiting their ideas about their national security. They're now at least talking for the first time since the end of the Second World War about disengagement from Europe and about focusing on protection of the Western Hemisphere. You might be completely cynical about this. You might say that this isn't really what the Americans are thinking or going to do, but the very fact that they're talking about it at all is unsettling for the Europeans at a time when the Europeans are conscious of the shifts in the global balance of power, the rise of powers like China, in fact, first and foremost, the rise of China and those sort of things. So, given all of this, you can understand the panic in Europe. Now, I have spoken many times in various programs, both here and even more about on the Duran, about how in Britain at least, even as the underlying socioeconomic situation deteriorates, we're going to see an increasingly authoritarian turn. And I've said that the overriding priority, or so it seemed to me, for the British political class, and this is true, by the way, of the wider European political class, is not to rebuild the European economies, to find some way forward, to do any of those things, but to retain control, and that they were prepared to use increasingly intrusive and authoritarian measures in order to do that. And well, over the last couple of days in Britain, we can see how that is increasingly playing out. Now, before the 2024 election, I said that I anticipated that a Starmer government would indeed take a more authoritarian turn. And, well, now, Prime Minister Starmer, as a solution to the various problems of Britain, what he is now proposing is digital ID systems. He says that this is a way of dealing with the problem of illegal migration, for example. And he's apparently unveiling this as his new signature program. And it seems that this is going to be quite a broad program overall, though I'm not clear about the details, and I'm not going to try and discuss those details anyway in this program. Now, the first thing to say is that this is not a new idea. The first person to float the idea of digital ID cards was Keir Starmer's ultimate mentor, the former Labour Prime Minister Tony Blair. I remember when he came up with that idea, Blair then encountered opposition within the Labour Party, especially from its more left-wing members, from various civil society groups, from the Conservative Party at that time, as I remember. I suspect that many Conservatives were inherently opposed to the idea of digital ID cards, but because it was Blair who was proposing it, just saying. But anyway, it's not a new idea because, as I said, at least 10 or perhaps even longer ago, I can remember Tony Blair coming up with something similar. It never happened then. Now it is being proposed all over again, and as far as I can understand it, this time it is being much more elaborated, and with the progress and advance of technology, it is going to be taken very much further. Now, I don't know whether it will be implemented. There's still some resistance to it, but I get the sense that it is not as strong as it was when Blair proposed it. But I would say that as far as I am concerned, this proposal definitely represents a further strong authoritarian turn. That was how this idea was perceived when Blair proposed it. It seems it is even more the case now. As I understand it, digital ID systems are going to contain information about a person's background. They're going to make it, at any rate, easier for the authorities to keep track on what is going on. And I'm not going to say more because, well, I don't know, again, the precise details. But anyway, this is where all of this is leading to. Now, I ought to say something else. Another factor that ought to make us all very suspicious of this whole idea is the way in which the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is selling it. Because he appears to be, as far as I can judge, selling this idea as a response to illegal migration. But Britain does not actually have a major problem of illegal migration. This is something that I've tried to explain many times, but many people who understand migration issues by reference to what is happening in the United States assume that Britain has the same issues of migration that the United States does. Now, I am not an American, but my understanding is that the great problem in the United States has been people who have been entering the United States illegally. Whether or not that is the case, and I believe it is, in Britain, the vast majority of people, or at any rate, a large majority of people who come to Britain do so legally. Yes, some people enter Britain illegally, but they are relatively few. So, if people enter Britain legally, then obviously ID cards is not a problem, is not addressing a major problem in the way that Keir Starmer is claiming. It seems to me that he is using the issue of illegal migration, which is a hot button issue for many people, as an excuse to move forward with this plan that has been lying around within the intestines of the British system for a long time, which was first floated by Tony Blair and which he is now adopting. And I'm going to say it, I don't think it is going to be the last step that the British authorities are going to take of this kind. And the European authorities, of course, seem to be going the same way. In a recent programme, I discussed the recent mayoral election in Ludwigshafen in Germany, how the AfD candidate there was banned from standing. I've been hearing extraordinary things about the justifications for that ban, even claims that part of the reason that he was banned from standing is that he spoke of his enthusiasm for Tolkien. I'm not sure that this is true, by the way, so don't assume that it is. But anyway, we see that the trend continues in the same way right across Europe. None of this, to put it mildly, addresses the true underlying problems in Europe, which are social and above all economic. European economies appear to be locked in conditions of deindustrialization and technological stagnation. There is escalating debt. There are worries about the future stability of the financial system. There's talk about bond crises in Britain and France. These are the real problems. And of course, there is the problem of the war as well, and the crisis with the Russians. But as I've said many times, this seems to me to be a crisis that can be most effectively addressed by diplomatic and political solutions. The solutions that have been tried up to now, doubling and tripling down on support for Ukraine, which is visibly losing the war, are not solutions at all. They're just a further way to deepen the crisis in Europe still further. Well, the worry must be that all of this tightening that is taking place, which we saw in Romania, which we might quite plausibly soon see in Moldova, which we might see in the Czech Republic, with all of its various other effects in Germany, with the election in Ludwigshafen, in Britain, with this new idea of ID cards and all of that. What it's going to do is going to make it not just more difficult for Britain and Europe to escape this economic and social cul-de-sac in which they find themselves in, but ensure that the crisis, when it comes, is going to be far worse than it would otherwise have been. One can control things for so long, but somebody once said that when it's precisely when change appears impossible that it becomes inevitable. And that, it seems to me, is the lesson that the political class in Britain and in Europe most needs to heed. You cannot stop events. You can only hold them back. But all you're doing, if you hold them back, is you are building up the tide behind the wall that you are creating. And eventually that tide will break through. And when it does, well, the roar of its waters will be mighty indeed. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish my program today. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.